welcome to this special edition of the Oncology Peer Review On The Go podcast. I'm your host, Matthew Fowler. As part of its OncView video series, Cancer Network spoke with Roy Herbst, Chief of Medical Oncology at Yale Cancer Center and Smillo Cancer Hospital in New Haven, Connecticut, about currently available treatment options and strategies in immunotherapy for treating non-small cell lung cancer.
So let's get started. What are the current approved therapies in non-small cell lung cancer?
Well, there are many. It's just incredible how many new drugs have been approved just this year alone. But for the immunotherapies right now, we have at least five drugs. We have certainly nivolumab, which came first, and then pembrolizumab, durvalumab, atezolizumab, and recently cemiplimab. And there are a whole host of others that are in clinical trials, some developed in the US, some in other countries, but there are many options right now. Of course, each of the drugs has its own indication. Pembrolizumab, of course, and atezolizumab and cemiplimab in the frontline, durvalumab in stage 3 disease. And of course, all the drugs are moving to earlier stages in this setting.
Great. And so how do you select the best therapy for a given patient? Like, for example, are there factors that maybe weigh efficacy versus safety or vice versa?
Well, it's nice to have the choices. Certainly, you would want to use an indication. So let's take frontline. Frontline, there are three agents for PD-L1 greater than 50%. Pembrolizumab, atezolizumab, and recently cemiplimab. I think, all three probably are reasonable to use. Probably use pembrolizumab just because it had come first, and that's what we're most accustomed to. In the setting where someone's PD-L1 less than 50%, most are using chemotherapy plus immunotherapy in that setting. Pembrolizumab is the most commonly used immunotherapy there. But, there are some who want to avoid immunotherapy and chemotherapy combinations and just use immunotherapy alone. And they might use nivolumab, ipilimumab, for example. So really a lot of options, but the one thing that is a constant is almost every patient who can get immunotherapy will get immunotherapy, because in metastatic lung cancer, it really is the only way to see a long-term outcome.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. And so I know you had mentioned chemo and immunotherapy. So what are some of the considerations when it comes to immunotherapy? Like, how would you decide if and when to use the combination of chemo and immunotherapy?
Well, in patients that don't have PD-L1 greater than 50% tumor proportion score, most would use chemo plus immunotherapy. Pembrolizumab, for example, is approved in the greater than 1% PD-L1 patients. But, those data suggest that the result is probably as good as chemotherapy, but not better. So for patients less than 50%, most physicians, myself included, would probably use chemotherapy plus immunotherapy. There are two major regimens. There's the KEYNOTE-189 regimen, pembrolizumab plus chemotherapy. And then there's, of course, the EMPOWER 150, which is bevacizumab, atezolizumab, a carboplatin paclitaxel. Also, you would use histologically specific chemo, depending whether it's squamous or non-squamous tumors. But I typically use chemoimmunotherapy in that setting. There are some who might use ipilimumab, nivolumab, but I think quite few.
So next, I want to focus a little bit on the monitoring response to therapy. So what are options for monitoring a patient on therapy? Like, for example, what are some indicators of relapse or progression of the disease?
Well, it certainly is important, both in a clinical trial, but now in clinic, as we have approved drugs, to make sure patients are responding or at least not progressing. So for immunotherapy, like anything else, we use radiographs and we look at partial response, stable disease, or progressive disease, usually using RECIST criteria, measurements on X-ray. Those can be somewhat, confounding, in immunotherapy patients, because you can have what's called pseudoprogression. It might be the tumor is actually going to respond, but because of the influx of immune cells, the tumor actually looks bigger and not smaller on X-ray. There are also some tumors that can take a really long time to respond. So they might be stable for a long time, or they might grow before they shrink. So it is a little bit hard to sometimes use that. The other thing about using X-rays is that, sometimes you'll get inflammation in the lung in lung cancer patients, or you'll have, pneumonia or infection. So now we're getting even more sophisticated. We're using ctDNA, so we can actually measure tumor burden. through cell-free DNA in the plasma. So that's being done more and more. And then, of course, you have to look at how the patient's feeling, at their performance status. You know, are they having any side effects? Are they up and about? So all of that put together would be something I would use in my clinic in monitoring a patient with immunotherapy.
Okay. And how often do you monitor your patients?
In practice, I still like to do every 2 months. Some could probably go as much as 3 months. We're talking about metastatic disease right now. But I usually do every 8 weeks, 8 to 10 weeks, I would get films. Usually it depends on the cycle. You know, it might even be, 6 weeks if you're giving the drugs every 3 weeks. So really, I usually do 2 cycles after a couple of rounds of if a patient is stable or responding, maybe you can stretch things out, and as we'll probably talk about, these drugs can be given for long periods of time. So you do want to minimize the number of tests the patient has to have.
Right. And does this monitoring vary by the type of therapy you're using?
Slightly, although most of the drugs are given on an every 3 week cycle, either alone or combined with chemotherapy. So it would probably be every 6 to 9 weeks that someone would do this. You usually do your restaging before you decide to give another round of therapy. ctDNA is becoming more and more common, though it's not the standard of care. Certainly, clinical judgment always is there, and as it should be.
Okay. And so you had mentioned pseudoprogression earlier. How big of a concern is that in non-small cell lung cancer?
Not as much as one would think. There are probably more papers on it than cases I've seen of it. It's probably, 5% at max. But, we have seen it. We've seen it here at Yale. We've written about it. So one has to be aware of it, but it's not as common in lung cancer as it was in melanoma. And even there, it's not that common.
Okay. And so what do you do, though, when you suspect progression but aren't sure? Do you continue therapy? Do we change therapy?
Well, if someone's stable, I would usually keep them on immunotherapy as long as possible. If they're progressing, how can I be sure? Certainly you could use tools to determine, is it infection? Sometimes you could do, blood cultures or, a bronchoscopy, diagnostically. If you think if it's inflammation, you could get a biopsy. But really, more and more, if you look at ctDNA, and that actually quantitatively measures the free DNA floating in the blood, that could be a way to sort of tell you that someone's stable or responding, even though the tumor might look a little bit bigger, or you're dealing with a pneumonitis, which is only high grade with these drugs in lung cancer, about 4 to 5%, but you can have a low grade pneumonitis, ground glass and other things that can be confounding for the response assessment.
Well, let's focus on ctDNA. Can you just explain what that is?
Well, ctDNA is a cell-free DNA. So you're actually looking at the DNA that's floating in the plasma, because, the tumor cells die or apoptose, and the DNA gets released. And actually measuring that, at serial time points in the course of a patient's, course can give you a quantitative measurement of how they're doing it. In fact, it's the best tumor marker. You're actually measuring tumor. And, this is a sophisticated technique. It's getting more and more sensitive. Normally what you would do is you would be looking at specific mutations and as a way to, sort of identify that tumor DNA. So there are 2 ways of doing it. You can use a test where you actually sequence the whole tumor and then you have the mutational profile and you look for it, or you can just pick a series of mutations and do it, ad hoc without having to sequence the tumor initially. I think both have pros and cons, but it's being used more and more. There were some very nice studies done recently. There's a large program that was run by the Friends of Cancer Research, a group out of Washington, D.C., a think tank that does studies to actually, raise the bar on how we monitor patients with cancer and treat them, and actually showed that the decrease in ctDNA in patients receiving immunotherapy with lung cancer correlated with survival. So it was with a response and survival. So this is becoming a more and more valid endpoint for future use.
Great. And so what do things like baseline ctDNA levels that might be above or below median or clearance of ctDNA, what are those telling us about a patient's likelihood of responding to immunotherapy, especially in these clinical trials?
Well, if you see the ctDNA going down, it tells you the patient is most likely responding. I think it's a pretty good bet if you see the ctDNA decreasing. So it's a positive sign. And if I had that, you know, it might tell me. It also tells me if it's stabilized, for example, maybe we've done enough. Maybe we're not seeing any change. Maybe we'd stop our therapy. These are all questions that have to be asked. I would suggest that you include a ctDNA measurement now whenever you get an x-ray measurement as a way to sort of validate those markers, those so-called surrogate markers.
Okay. And with that recommendation, how might ctDNA be used to monitor non-small cell lung cancer patients? For example, like true versus pseudo progression or early detection of progression happening?
All of the above. So in pseudo progression, you would not see ctDNA going up. Mm-hmm. In progression, you would. So if you saw a tumor that looked bigger, but ctDNA was stable, that's telling you it's probably a pseudo progression, some sort of inflammation. Minimal residual disease is another amazing thing that we're doing now. Mm-hmm. In fact, why treat patients with adjuvant therapy after surgery, after chemo radiation, if they don't need it? So you can identify patients, for example, the recent data with atezolizumab from Empower 10, which basically showed that in patients with stage 2 and 3 disease, PD-L1 greater than 1%, receiving atezolizumab as adjuvant therapy after surgery, there was an improvement in disease-free survival. That tells you that, you know, these drugs work in that adjuvant setting. Imagine if you could predict only those patients who had significant ctDNA post-surgery, maybe some would not have to be treated. So that definitely makes sense.
Okay, great. And what assays are available to test ctDNA, and have you had any experience using any of them?
We have not. We do this in the research labs at Yale. Mm-hmm. You know, there are tests that can look at this, like the Guardant tests, and Foundation Medicine has a test, and other companies. Most of those are looking at mutational profiles, but I believe that they can also look at quantitative amounts of DNA and correlate that with outcome.
We have other aspects that go into clinical decisions. So first, how do you handle when a patient might request a drug holiday?
Well, you know, everyone likes holidays, right? You know, the immunotherapy is amazing. I've been doing this for 25, 30 years, the treatment of lung cancer. And only in the last decade have I seen the amazing results of immunotherapy. But if someone's had a year or two and they're stable and doing well, coming every 3 weeks is tough. And these drugs do produce some fatigue and some side effects. So why not stop? If someone's gone for a year or two, and they're stable, no evidence of disease, and they want to take a holiday, I'll usually let them do it. And I base this on Keynote 10 and Keynote 24. I was actually the primary author of Keynote 10. We just published the 5-year outcome in the Journal of Thoracic Oncology. And for those patients who had a partial response and got through 2 years, very few of them relapsed, and only 10 to 15% so far. And actually, those that do relapse, more than half of them respond again if you give their drug. If you give back the pembrolizumab. So my thought is many of these patients could be, dare I say, cured, you know, after 2 years. And if they're not, we know we can rescue them or at least stabilize the disease by giving the immunotherapy again. So I am a proponent of stopping therapy, you know, if we can. Now, there are some patients where maybe the tumors responded, but they might have one area that's growing, oligometastatic disease. Mm-hmm. I've had some cases where I've actually either radiated or done surgery, and then either stop the drug or gone on with immunotherapy a little longer until things are stable. So you have to look at a case-by-case basis. Many will tell you to treat until progression. But I think, you know, if you've gotten a couple of years out and someone's had a good response, I think it's okay to stop.
Okay. And is there any information out there that makes this an easier decision for you?
There are very few studies. There were a couple of studies that looked at treatment for a year versus till progression. I think the data, this was with nivolumab, I think the data slightly favored treating longer. We need more data. We need ctDNA data. We need, you know, it's very hard to do a randomized trial. Suppose you're the patient that gets to the group that stops at 1 year versus those that keep going and you're doing well, you know, how would one feel? So these are hard studies to do. But I think, you know, we'll learn more with looking molecularly at ctDNA, looking at how much tumor burden there is in a more molecular way. So stay tuned in the next couple of months to year.
Absolutely. And I think you touched upon this already, but we typically treat with immunotherapy for 2 years. Do we always need to treat for the full 2, or is it beneficial maybe to treat for longer than the 2 years?
We don't know. That's the problem. I can tell you, I've had patients I've treated for 3 or 4 months. they've had great response, but they've also had toxicity, and they've had to stop the pembrolizumab, and they're alive 5-6 years later. So they obviously readjusted their rheostat of the immune system, so that was enough. Mm-hmm. And then I've had patients I've treated for several years where they've never had a partial response, but they've been stable. And I've got some people who have on therapy more than 3 or 4 years. Every once in at 3 or 4 years, most patients will say, "Doctor, can I have a little break?"
Mm-hmm. Okay. And so I know you'd mentioned that we need more information to be able to make this decision, and that hopefully, you know, ctDNA will get us there. Is there any other additional information or testing that might support this decision?
Well, imaging, you know, more than just CT imaging, maybe PET scanning. And there might, I would predict at some point we'll have ways to follow T cells in the immune microenvironment and actually, you know, label CD8 positive T cells and look at those. Stay tuned, or label PD-L1 so we can actually look at the immune microenvironment, you know, in a patient, and that might help us determine sites and areas of embers of tumors that have still not totally been eradicated.
Absolutely. Well, thank you so much, Dr. Herbst.
I know it's been a pleasure chatting with you today. It's an exciting area. When you have drugs that work, now, of course, we have to hone in and figure out in whom they work best and use them more. And there are some patients where, if we know it's not going to work, that's where research has to look for combinations of drugs and therapies. We just presented some very nice data at ESMO, where we actually, in the COAST study, where we used durvalumab post-chemo radiation, for example, and we combined durvalumab with two experimental agents. One that targets CD73 and another that targets natural killer cells. And in both cases, the results looked better than the durvalumab alone. So I would predict that in the next few years, we're going to start seeing new immune combinations that can be used in these settings.
Don't forget to subscribe to the Oncology Peer Review On The Go podcast on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or anywhere podcasts are available. Or listen online at cancernetwork.com/resources/podcasts. The Oncology Peer Review On The Go podcast is the official podcast of Cancer Network, the home of the journal Oncology. For more information, visit us at cancernetwork.com and find us on Twitter @CancerNetwork without the O, or on Facebook and LinkedIn @CancerNetwork.